Hello again, everyone, and welcome to my review of Much Ado About Nothing. I saw it twice. I saw the matinee Saturday show and on the 21st in the evening. According to Facebook, incidentally, I was at the same King's College Gardens on the same day last year watching the CSF. What are the odds, eh? Well, actually, they're probably quite easy to work out. Last year, I was there on the 21st of July for A Midsummer Night's Dream, and this year, it was for Much Ado About Nothing. Yet another one of my very favourite plays. I know there's so many of them. But with the exception of Twelfth Night, the early comedy that's got most about it, which is, despite being brilliantly funny, also extraordinarily deep and meaningful. And we're alerted to this almost right away by the title, which can be taken in a variety of ways. Much Ado About Nothing. Well, nothing happened between Hero and any man before her proposed marriage to Claudio, and yet there was much ado about it, a great big fuss. So in that way, it's a title a bit like As You Like It or What You Will, but even more than those, this one is open to multiple interpretations, as it sets the scene for the key language, the puns and the imagery, as well as the main themes of the play. It's important to remember that in Shakespeare's day, nothing was pronounced the same as noting. So it means noting to me, for example, for it means nothing to me. And this play is all about people noting other people, often mistakenly so, and often again, causing much ado, a great big fuss. It permeates the language from the beginning to the end of the play, along with the synonym Mark. Claudio asks very early on, do you note Count Leonato's daughter? Benedict continues with, yes, I noted her, and then uses Mark and continues with the speech. And these two words echo throughout the play, and they play off the other word, nothing. Of course, people don't just note incorrectly, they also note things truly. The turning point of the play is when the friar notes Hero's face and declares her innocent. The main meaning, however, or one of the, maybe I shouldn't say the main, but certainly one of the main meanings, is rather rude because, like most of Shakespeare's comedies, and indeed tragedies, and indeed everything else he wrote, and everything else his compatriots note, it's extremely bawdy. And most of the scenes and the lines can be taken with a sexual meaning. And in the title, it's a meaning that permeates nearly every scene of the play. And everything follows on from this. Basically put, a man has a thing between her legs and a woman has nothing between her legs. And the much ado, the big fuss, is over that very nothing, Hero's nothing. This was a very common pun in Elizabethan England. And it appears elsewhere in Shakespeare as well as this place. Once you add to that the ring with which it felicitously rhymes, you've got two strains of the bawdiest Elizabethan puns running together with their obvious impact on whether there will be a wedding ring or not. Now, back in the day, neither women nor men were shocked by such language. Female characters in Shakespeare often outbody the men on stage. Witness as one example here, Margaret's bravura performance of lewd suggestions to Benedict late in the play. Furthermore, Shakespeare easily moves from the physical to the spiritual or philosophical, as with the two meanings of ring and with the two main meanings of nothing. This is unsurprising. Shakespeare, after all, as a child, probably saw, and certainly they were prevalent throughout England, the late medieval mystery plays, which were full of body, full of bodily humour, toilet jokes, and so forth, amid scenes reenacting the most sublime moments of the Bible. To the Elizabethans, the earthy and the godly coexist. They don't rub each other out. Elizabethan writers and audiences did not split life into boxes of decorum. Instead, they embraced it all. Later revisionists, of course, were so shocked by this that they tried to rewrite Shakespeare by taking out all the what they called low bits. You can't, of course, low bits, of course, being a bit of a pun in itself. You can't, of course, or at least you can't without destroying the play, as it's built into their very foundations. Yet another pun in the title, and another crucial one, which is why I hesitated to call the last one the main one, is that noting and nothing both work at the same time. So in fact, very often people are noting nothing or not a thing, or noting a no thing. I know that sounds very strange, but for three absolutely crucial examples, Benedict notes that Beatrice has said she loves him, but no such thing had occurred. Beatrice notes that Benedict has said that he loves her, but no such thing occurred. And most crucially of all, Don Pedro and Claudio note Hero being unfaithful, but no such thing occurred. So you can see from the title alone that it's a very witty play, multi-leveled. You don't have to get every level at once, of course. It goes from deep thought to silly humour, to body humour, to great physical comedy, to moments of tragedy, to moments of heartbreak, and back again. And round it goes. And our setting for this wonderful play was the King's College Gardens, as I mentioned. And I mentioned I was there last year. But this year, for the first time ever at the festival, as far as I'm aware, we were facing the other way. Instead of having our backs to the beautiful pergola, we were actually looking at it. Now, I was there both in the day and the night, and to say that the pergola works would be an understatement. It's an absolutely marvellous setting, and it was used very cleverly by the director, also the artistic director of the whole festival, David Crilly. It was his triumph, this particular one. But the greatest thing of his triumph, possibly, for all I'm going to mention in a few moments, was that on the afternoon show, he managed to make the sky overcast so that the sun wasn't blinding the audience. A really clever touch, that. I should mention that the audiences at both the performances I saw were absolutely enraptured. There were outbreaks of spontaneous applause. There was virtually non-stop laughter. And this and the Saturday matinee one, this wasn't just from the actors visiting from the other plays. In fact, I think, if anything, the rest of the audience laughed even louder. The audience on the 21st of July was very large, not so much so at the matinee, but I think this was down to the fact that the weather, or at least the BBC weather that I was following on the Friday, predicted rain just at the time of the play all the way through Friday. As it happens, there wasn't rain, but I think the prediction had lowered the crowd somewhat. It certainly didn't lower their enthusiasm, though. The discovery scenes were absolutely hysterical. And as I was saying, David Crilly's staging using the pergola was really just marvellous. When Benedict discovered that Beatrice loved him, but of course he didn't. It's quite difficult he didn't really, is what I mean. She hadn't really said it at that point. But his discovery of that, him hiding, was just absolutely marvellous. And I did see it a few years ago, Much Ado About Nothing in London, where David Tennant was very funny at this bit. But this was even much better. It's to do with the setting, with the proximity, the close, the character's interaction with the audience, the fact you're in daylight. Oh, there's a whole book about this out there somewhere. You should dig it out. The characters' movements around the pergola were just marvellous. Dogberry appeared on a cart with a bell. The verger's hearing aid. There were so many touches. There was such attention to detail that it was a really directorial triumph, shall we say. And David Crilly's musical background was very much to the fore. The opening and closing songs utterly delighted the audiences, and songs throughout were pertinent and moving. And speaking of moving, I'm moving on to the characters now, and I'm going to start with Benedict and Beatrice. Okay, Hero and Claudio, in a way, are the centre of the story, but we all do, deep in our hearts, think about this play as Benedict and Beatrice. No less a figure than Charles II, wrote Benedict and Beatrice beside the title or Much Ado About Nothing in his copy of the second folio, which of course exists, or we wouldn't know that. So starting with Benedict, Rory Thursby gave a standout performance. His interaction with the audience, far less his interaction with Beatrice and the other characters, was absolutely top rate. It was a captivating performance, and it was full of tremendous physical humour. The discovery scene I was mentioning before, kind of false discovery scene that then becomes true, it's hard to know how to refer to it really, was absolutely breathtaking. Both when he was on, under, and crawling about the bench, when he was covered by a blanket and people were sitting on him. It sounds very silly and straightforward, but the audience were in stitches. I had tears rolling down my face on the first time I saw it. Absolutely marvellous. There's a moment where three people are sitting on him, pretending they don't know he's there, and they're having a conversation, and you suddenly hear him saying, "Get off!" It's just absolutely marvellous. To top even that was him clambering drunkenly all over the top of the pergola and throwing himself vigorously into bushes and behind trees. Health and safety must have taken the summer off, and thank God for that, we all say. His delivery of lines and his facial expressions, he was just a magnetic presence throughout. And while he was masked at the early revelries, he put on a ridiculously exaggerated false French accent, which was very funny itself in its own way. And as if all of that wasn't enough, he was also in The Watch, of which more later. Beatrice was played by Gemma Paget, and she was so fiery and so fine and so, well, she was so Beatrice. She was quite magnificent in her anger as she strode across the garden, so very much against her will, to bid Benedict to come in to dinner, only to be confronted by the new Benedict, he that was convinced of her love for him. She didn't just interact with Benedict, though of course for all of us that's the highlight. She was also very strong in her support for Hero, and so witty throughout. She was absolutely delightful, as was Amy Wright as Hero. But actually Amy was almost too lovely in character, spirits and looks with her sparkling smile, because it made the disgraceful attack upon her all the more unbearable. Her easygoing nature with Hero and Margaret, her pure love for Claudio, her crucial relationship with her father, all of these finely portrayed, and she was truly heart-wrenching when clinging to Robert Gall's Leonato's arm and sheltering behind him in the immediate aftermath of the false but heavily supported accusations against her. She also appeared in The Watch. The Watch were all heavily disguised, always a very good thing, I think. They were really heavily disguised, and none more so than Amy Hero's sexton. She actually seemed to come out almost from a completely different play. I thought, who is this new cast member? It seemed to come vaguely in my mind from Simon Bell's Comedy of Errors a couple of years ago. So that was absolutely excellent as well. Claudio, well, as with Amy's Hero, Christopher Arkeston portrayed a much more rounded character than this role is often given. Not allowing this pair, Claudio and Hero, to be completely overshadowed by the famous Benedict and Beatrice is something that's never easy, and it's rarely successful, to be honest, but here it was. I think Claudio is a particularly hard character to play, as his reward at the end so outweighs his just deserts for his lack of faith and terrible behaviour. Yes, I know I'm probably not supposed to think that way, and you're supposed to think they're just good people innocently duped, but it's really hard. I always do think that way, and I think everyone else does too. One little thing, the only slight negative I'm going to say in the whole day, and it's nothing to do with Christopher, one thing I think was missing in the play was we skipped over it was only mentioned, so we didn't actually see his repentance the night before his wedding. We didn't see his repentance at the grave of at the tomb of Hero. Now, I know there's a limited time, and I know it could very well be argued that the repentance that he's made to undergo is so woefully inadequate in any case that you might as well skip it. But I think it just makes the ending not quite so jarring that he gets his Hero in the end, because he doesn't deserve her. That's my opinion. Christopher also provided a lovely comic touch as Claudio when he adopted Benedict's false French accent, when he was pretending to be Benedict when everyone was masked. Christopher was also in The Watch, and he managed to sketch out, this is very clever actually, he managed to sketch out a full character despite having very few lines, purely by his tone of voice and the ostentatious way he stared at his fingertips. You very much got the impression of a character who didn't really care very much about, or certainly didn't care about The Watch, and didn't seem to care very much about anything in particular. After his sparkling debut in last year's festival, who will ever forget Angus Phyllis Stewart's wonderful Coriolanus, he pops up here as Don Pedro. Bearded, as nearly all the male cast are this year, every male member of every cast seems to be bearded, almost. And it's very appropriate in this particular play to one of Beatrice's wonderful early speeches. Anyway, he tops this moustache with he tops this beard with a magnificent moustache, and his costume very cleverly sets him out as the prince, the ruler. And he plays that part. He's authoritative, he's cheery, he commands respect and good feelings before it all goes wrong. He also manfully struggles to suppress his laughter in the face of his friends Benedict Grant's over what Beatrice revealed in the masked revelries. So he's an impressively in-control figure, especially, for example, when explaining the true nature of what has happened to Claudio and presenting that lucky chap with the hand of the lovely Hero. He also brings genuine sadness to what is often only a comic moment when he mock, if it is a mock, when he mock proposes himself to Beatrice and she flatly rejects the idea. Perhaps Angus's greatest achievement in the role, however, is keeping the character going after the calamitous duping. It's very hard to accept his and Claudio's credulity and subsequent behaviour at the false wedding scene. The play does clearly state they're innocent dupes, but as I said above, I find it very hard to feel this or to have the necessary forgiveness. However, before they realise what's happened to them, there is a period where the audience have to accept that, and despite knowing their folly and their abusive hero. Angus goes through this period very well, because he's still the Don Pedro of the play's opening. When, for example, he's mimicking our beloved constable, just before the truth is finally revealed to the horror-stricken Don Pedro and Claudio. When he's dealing with Benedict, even though he doesn't realise that Benedict's earnest in his challenge to Claudio for quite some time, at that point Don Pedro is still Don Pedro, despite what we know and what he doesn't know. Angus is also in the watch. You can see the amount of doubling that's going on, and has some marvellous interplay with the irrepressible Dogberry, of whom more later. Joanne Cordell's Margaret was deliciously saucy throughout. As mentioned previously, she outbodies the quick-witted Benedict with ease, and she has an absolutely marvellous episode where she lewdly fingers the spout of a watering can as she trumpets the virtues of Benedict, until the desired result is produced, and then both she and Hero give a long, deep sigh of contentment. This is followed by another one of the many high points of physical comedy, when Beatrice gets a soaking from the same watering can that has been substituting for Benedict's good or bad parts, depending on your point of view. This was all wonderfully done, as was the way she led Baraccio away from the party with obvious and gleeful intent. She was more than just saucy, however. The camaraderie with Hero and Beatrice early on and the wedding gown discussion certainly point to other virtues of the young lady. So what a trio of lovely and spirited women Leonato had under his roof. Speaking of Leonato, this was such a great role for Robert Gall. As he can show the many sides of his acting abilities and experiences, because Leonato goes through so very many different emotional states. Rob has had his comic roles in the past at the festival, and of course his tragic roles, and he recently starred in marvellously as Ivanov in Chekhov's play of that name. And he brought all that to bear. The solemnity and strength of his flat, unshakable statement, "I will be heard," when Don Pedro, his superior in rank, after all, tried to brush him off, where it was just stunning. An injured father will not have this, is what he was saying. He moved from genial host to this outraged force of nature. Leonato has all the moods of mankind, all the moods I've mentioned and many more, and Gall portrays them all exquisitely. The glint in his eye when he then proposes straight after saying, "I will be heard," when he then is heard, and he then proposes his niece as a substitute, was a brilliant touch. His face speaks volumes throughout. This is true actually whatever the scene or situation, and no matter whether Rob is playing a prominent role or not. He's always working to give each scene more expression. One example would be the delighted surprise on his face when Don Pedro joined in the ongoing song when sitting beside him on the garden bench. Adam Elms, another shining star in his CSF debut year last year, continued his impressive run with a captivating pair of roles. First of all, his Don John was a stuttering. I wondered actually if this was to imply some psychological basis for his malignancy over and above the bastard issue and playing second fiddle to the albeit clearly worthier Don Pedro. Just a thought. Anyway, whichever way, it worked very well. His stares were incredible, piercing, foreboding, quite frightening at times. It just seems that Adam Elms can conjure up any emotion at will. His Don John was, as the play script clearly means him to be, malignant but also totally inept. He needs to be led painfully, step by step, by the cunning Baraccio. These scenes, when the main plot was being coached to him by Baraccio, was played out with delicious body language and great humour. Adam outdid even this, however, with his rapturously received Dogberry. His interpretation here is a work of art in its own right, side-splittingly funny, and yet more too, really. It pretty much has to be seen to be believed. I think my catchphrase of the year so far may well be his special laugh. especially when echoed by Peter Pearson's wonderful verger with his hunchback and hearing aid as visual props. Peter's interplay with Adam is magnificently timed throughout. Pearson also plays the vital part of Friar Francis, very much the saviour of the day, and in the opening scenes he also greases the wheels of the conversations between the men returning from war and the ladies of Leonato's home, and he helps to propel the plot along with an easy charm. It may say something about my morality, but I was very drawn to Michael Cumming's Baraccio, a cheerful rogue, cunning, seemingly at first without a conscience, and very, very clever until drunk. He had to be so patient with Don John. But you felt he was going to burst in containing his demeanour to his boss, as it were. Which, of course, is perfect for the text. The realisation of what he'd done when he discovers that Hero is dead. I just realised he discovers that Hero is dead, but of course she's not dead. But he thinks she's dead. The realisation of what he thinks has happened is shown brilliantly on his face. This is very important because it makes his later change of heart more believable. But he was great throughout. His interplay with Margaret was wonderful. From lurking in the shadows at the beginning to his repentant state at the close, it was a very fine performance. As a couple of extra notes on the 21st, I don't think this was deliberate, but the sash fell from Don John's waist down to his ankles and perhaps was about to trip him up, though thankfully Adam Elms seemed to realise it in time. As I say, I don't think it was deliberate, but the strange thing was it actually chimed with what was being said, so perhaps I'm doing them a disservice here. But either way, it started off in Michael Cumming's a fit of the giggles, which he managed to suppress with great effort, I suspect. And later on in the play, when there was a completely inappropriate firework display in the second half, whilst he was a prisoner and in considerable shame, he also had to suppress giggles there. And he did it. I had to watch very closely to see the heaving shoulder. As I say, the audiences, both times I saw it, were in hysterics. There were spontaneous applause. They were demand for repeated encore. And it's just amazing to think all of the actors I've been describing above are at the same time rehearsing for the second part of the festival. I can never get my head around this. I know that for the actors, I think the actors sometimes laugh at me because I'm so surprised at it, but I do find it just astonishing that they're performing this and they're rehearsing other things. So at the moment, Robert Gall's not only playing Leonato, but he's rehearsing Kent, another role you just know he's going to be brilliant at. And speaking of such confidence, we've got Angus Villars-Stewart as being Oberon soon, and just so much to look forward to. Peter Pearson as Bottom. You can see the humour already. You can see the whole thing building up, and just I just doff my cap to them all. From director to every member of the cast, a really thrilling performance that roused the crowd and got standing ovations that were very well deserved.